This is the Bristol Cable.
There's going to be debate, isn't there, about ideas. It will get spicy, seeing what some people think of what Labour has put forward. But, you know, post-May, once the dust settles, the residents of Bristol can't afford for us not to work with other parties as is necessary to get what we need to done.
I'm Neil Maggs, and this is Bristol Unpacked, speaking to fascinating Bristolians on topics where others may fear to tread. Brought to you by the city's community-owned media, the Bristol Cable. In this episode of Bristol Unpacked, it's the first of our Bristol election specials. We are talking to the leaders of each of the main political parties in the city. So first up is Labour, its leader Tom Renard, who is the councillor for Horfield. Enjoy. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Neil. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you.
Your role as the new local Labour leader, I think, I'm just trying to think how many you've had. You've got Asher Craig, Craig Cheney, Nicola Beach, Helen Holland. All these people have stood down. So were you the only one left that they could choose?
No. I mean, there's a few cabinet members carrying on. I think about half the cabinet.
Is it half? Okay.
So you got Dondry standing as well.
Yeah.
As is Miley. This is now going to test my memory of my cabinet colleagues and potentially offend someone, isn't it?
There's a lot of newbies, though, isn't there? I went through the list and I got to admit, there's a lot of them I don't even recognise or know the names of. Is that usual?
Yeah, it's not unusual to get quite a bit of churn within a group. It's about half our group that are standing down of the 23 councillors that we have. And I think, you know, it's obviously prophetic in some ways, obviously going to a different governance system. I think that's made the decision for some people that change. Also, others like Helen, 33 years on the council, decided that, you know, now's the time to do other things and spend more time with her family.
Stressful. It can be quite a stressful role. Obviously, I've spoken to a lot of politicians on this show. People don't always think about the human, do they? They just see you as a sort of, sometimes as a hologram for sort of frustrations and things to sort of chuck at a bit. So you've got to have quite broad shoulders. Are you ready for the task?
I believe I am, yeah. I know I'm relatively new. I was only elected in the last cycle in May 21 and then was straight into cabinet a few weeks after I got elected. But very much up for it. Want to offer a vision for the city that we hope residents and voters will support and then make sure that we continue to do good stuff in the city. And, you know, I've obviously drawn a lot from my experience of being in cabinet for almost 3 years now as well, with what's not been wasn't a particularly easy brief, to be fair.
And how did you get chosen? What's the process?
So people could put themselves forward and then there's a vote. Is the short version of that. It's the Labour group elects its lead. I think, I assume the other parties do the same sort of process, but I don't know.
Across the whole of Bristol?
Oh, no, just the councillors. So it's the
Labour. Members, just councillors, yeah? Okay. Who did you beat?
I want to say.
And are we not allowed to know? Is it not a public thing?
It's a closed process. So, I think that the outcome was me getting elected, though. So I think that's the key point. And now we're focused
on... Don't have to tell me, though, if you don't want to tell me who, was it quite a big majority? Was it narrow? Or was it close?
I wouldn't know anyway because it's a closed ballot. So we do a secret ballot. And
Okay. I mean, but as you just said yourself, you haven't been, so you were elected in May 2021. Mm. Yeah. So you haven't been a councillor for that long. That is quite a meteoric rise.
Yeah, it's been quick. I think probably not what I expected to happen, to be fair. But I think I was quite keen to push forward a particular vision for taking us forward. And I think particularly with there being a lot of change, you've got some key people standing down. So yeah, I guess we are where we are with it. And I think for me, having had the housing brief as well for the last few years, I think there was something for me about making sure that we carry on the work that we're doing around house building, but also really sort of focusing on trying to do more around council housing, which is one of our key pledges, as well as other types of housing. So we know that the market will build homes, right? But we need to make sure we're building the homes that help to address the housing crisis that we're facing. I think that really something I feel really strongly and really passionately about and want to drive forward.
And that obviously, talking about the, I guess, being in the public eye or having some degree of pressure, that particular brief housing is quite kind of loaded in the city anyway, isn't it? So do you feel that you're kind of, it's been a good, I guess, sort of grounding to step into this?
Definitely. I think, you know, it's a brief where you can do things and do some quite exciting things. It's also a brief with huge challenges. You're dealing with, you know, people's lives and really challenging housing situations, people that aren't appropriately housed, and you deal with some really difficult situations. So I think it does give you a good grounding in really making sure that you feel able to step up and deal with some quite challenging situations. Dealt with a lot around building safety in particular in about 18 months after I was elected and appointed to cabinet. And I think it gives you a really good understanding of what people go through and why we need to get more homes, the right homes built in the city as well, to get people into better homes, and also make sure we're investing in our existing stock as well, because I think not everywhere still got council housing in the country. And in some ways, we're quite fortunate that we still do. And it's about 14% of all homes our local authority owns in the city, give or take. So, you know, it's been very interesting. I've learned a lot. I've overseen a budget that, you know, is, well, for this coming financial year, it's £151 million as a revenue budget for housing.
And, you know, in brief, your kind of background pre-politics in different roles you're involved in. I think you still are involved in a mental health charity, is that right?
So not involved. So I'm still freelancing a bit for National Mind, although I haven't done that time to do as much as I've done historically. It's been very much focused on council and cabinet roles. And I used to run a mental health charity as well, which I stepped down from early last year, having had my first child in 2022, trying to do that cabinet counsellor and also run a charity. We're not going to work alongside sleep.
And I know something is that the outgoing Mayor Marvin often talks about is that people often come into politics like before they have kids or sort of after they have kids. And there's this little bit in the middle where people feel that they, you know, because for the reasons you say, it's really difficult, it's really tricky. But actually, should we sort of be encouraging more people and actually remove more barriers for people with families and young children to be in politics?
Absolutely. You know, politics and politicians need to be representative of the communities around them, and that includes people with young families. So I think there is more we need to do. We've introduced a parental leave policy now for councillors that went through full council in March, which is something I've been working on with others to get something that's clear in place that we can then build upon. And I think, you know, to be fair to Marvin, like, he's always been very inclusive. You know, there's always been space for, you know, if I needed to bring the kids to work, I've even brought my little one to a cabinet meeting on one occasion. So, you know, it's always been a good environment. I think that culture is really important that gets created to make it feel like that people, one, can stand, and that's about what they see, but two, that when you do stand, that the meetings are accessible, that, you know, if things go awry with childcare, I mean, childcare can be a bit of a nightmare at the best of times.
I want to talk a little bit about opposition, actually, first, if that's right, before we get on to your pledges. You've said yourself, let's do the Greens first. You've accused the Greens of a total abdication of their responsibility as elected councillors in February 2024. Pretty strong stuff. What did you mean by that? And what's your kind of general view with the Greens in Bristol?
Yeah, I think my concerns stem from an inability for them to sort of step up and make big decisions. And I think, you know, those comments in the context of the budget, I think it wasn't it. So where there have been no proposed amendments put forward, no alternative suggestions, just criticism of a budget, you know, we have to deal with the reality of the situation. You know, that is politics. That is what leaders have to do. You've got a reality in front of you and you've got to deal with that. You've got to deal with the hands you dealt with. And that, you know, as part of that is, you know, local government funding is really challenging. And we've got some really challenging issues within that around cost of adult social care, cost of children's services and things like that. So I think just not stepping up to offer alternative suggestions if you don't like what's being proposed it doesn't feel like leadership to me. I think that's the first thing I'd say. And obviously they don't whip as a group. So, you know, how can you get a clear direction? We had suggestions from other parties and where that was possible, we incorporated them.
Just to clarify that, those are no. So yeah, the Green Party, obviously in the Labour Party, you whip, i.e. you kind of have to stay on a kind of a particular message Green Party, it's like, you know, like cats. They can go in any direction and say what they want, which some people think is liberating and, you know, allows for, you know, individual endeavor. But obviously it makes it quite difficult sometimes to, I guess, keep party discipline a little bit.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we do discuss, you know, that the position that we take on issues, you know, when we're voting on motions, for example, that, we're, you know, when we're talking about the budget, you know, we will discuss as a group and form a view, and we can opt for a free vote on things. We don't usually, but, you know, there will be that discussion within our group. And then we come usually with a united position because, you know, we have to give some certainty to driving things forward in the city, you know, investment.
So you see them as just blocking, you just see them as sort of, you know, in a slightly privileged position, not having to make any real decisions, you know, having any real responsibility, just being obstructive and contrary for the sake of it. My only pushback for you is, isn't that the role of opposition though? Isn't that exactly what Labour do to the Tories nationally?
Well, I think to an extent it's
opposition.
Isn't
that what you would do if you were in opposition? You wouldn't be signing off all the green budgets and green policies, would you, surely?
Well, what we'd be doing, and as Labour has been doing nationally, is we would offer an alternative proposal, alternative solutions, as we have done on childcare, as we have done on housing, as we have done on planning, as we have done on many issues. We've got our policy platforms. The closer we get to the election, the more that there'll be, that'll get clear because the manifesto will come out much closer to the general election. So I do think it is incumbent on us, where, particularly if we're in opposition, to offer up alternative solutions if we don't like what's being proposed. I think opposing for opposing's sake doesn't really help anyone. To the extent, that's probably just a par for the course in local politics.
Yeah, I think that's true. I wouldn't say there's a huge amount of policy detail in what Labour have put forward nationally at the moment, is there?
Well, I think you've got the five missions, haven't you? You've got GB Energy and switching on GB Energy, which is talking about how we get, you know, renewable energy scaled up and really decarbonise the country. Talked a bit about getting the NHS back on its feet, and there's been bits and pieces of the detail. The full detail we set out in the manifesto.
Yeah, these are kind of like mission statements, though, aren't they? Rather than, you know, specific policies. Well, so you think that will change as we move towards the likelihood of sort of October, November general election?
There has been policy announcements that kind of hook onto those things. So, you know, I think that we talked quite extensively about childcare, that then the Tories basically adopted our childcare proposals.
Yeah. The challenge, isn't it, Tom? Because a lot of people will say, well, you know, well, okay, it's very great saying we're going to do this and that and the other, but what are you actually specifically going to do? And then you announce a policy and then it gets nicked.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that they've taken on the childcare policy. You know, I've got a 2-year-old, you know, yeah, and I'll be able to make use of those extra hours when they come online for us in September. So, you know, ultimately it's about what's best for individuals and for residents. So if they're nicking the Labour's ideas, then, you know,
then we'll that's take a good that thing. Because the Greens would say that's what Labour have done locally with sort of some of the climate emergency stuff, wouldn't they? They would say that, oh, you know, you've stolen what we suggested in the first place.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't think they were proposing City Leap, for example. You know, I think that, you know, that's our big decarbonisation plan. You know, it's been quite the journey, which I've only sort of been one very small part of at a distance. But, you know, I think we've done a lot there. Our work around housing and retrofitting our homes, you know, the proposals got supported. There wasn't anything extra that was being proposed. So I think actually Labour's been doing quite a lot to lead on the climate agenda, and that we've got really ambitious proposals.
But the general point is, I think it is, but for all parties really, it is quite tricky when to fully reveal your hand, you know, or keep your gunpowder dry. I guess it's about timing.
Yeah.
I guess what you're saying is they're not coming with solutions, they're just coming with opposing some Labour's ideas. Lib Dems?
I mean, we haven't had much to do with them because obviously quite a small group. At least they put forward some ideas for the budget. So, you know, I think that we've not got sort of many contests with them in the forthcoming election. It'll be interesting to see how they do in some of the seats that they're targeting, to be fair.
Tories?
Well, you know, the arch nemesis, as it were. So, you know, I think for us, obviously, there was quite a constructive engagement from them in the local budget setting process. But, you know, it'd be remiss of me not to point out that sometimes some of the issues that they raise with the party about maybe where it's state of roads and things like that, you're kind of looking at them going, well, better go have a word with your national government then that's been in charge for 14 years and is the reason we've got some of these problems in the city. And I find some of that cognitive dissonance that you sometimes get quite interesting.
I think it's interesting, isn't it, the local makeup's obviously changed in the last, 4 years, eight years, where, and we mentioned Lib Dems, where he would have been considered at one stage the main opposition to Labour in Bristol. That has completely flipped to the Green Party now, who obviously have one more council seat than Labour. What do you put the Green surge down to, Tom?
It's a good question. I think it's tricky for me because I wasn't around in the throes of it between 2016 and 2021 for some of the things that had happened there. I think once you're in office, any administration will do things that gradually will make them unpopular in certain quarters by the virtue of the decisions that you make. Some people won't like some of those decisions and maybe things that don't go as well as one would have liked. I think, you know, it was quite a unique election as well, given that we were still in the throes of COVID. You know, it was obviously delayed a year until May 21. And I think from memory, most of us weren't even able to campaign until kind of mid-April, give or take. And so you have some of those things. One of the things that Labour really focuses on is getting out and talking to voters. And we had limited opportunity to do that in 2021. But, you know, we're making the most of that opportunity this time, making sure, you know, that every week at the moment, we're talking to thousands of people across the city, understand what their views are on different topics, understand what their priorities are, what their concerns are. If they aren't voting Labour, why aren't they voting Labour?
And what are you getting back from that? So obviously, in terms of details, I think I've got this right. There's 25 Green councillors at the moment in Bristol and 24 Labour, is that right?
23 now.
23.
That's resigned
as a... So I guess to sort of break this down, is that a reaction to perhaps changes in national Labour? Obviously, there's been a big shift from sort of Corbyn to Starmer, you know, rightly or wrongly, depending on your perspective or politics. Clearly become more electable, you know, and all the polls are indicating a general election landslide for Labour. So is that, you know, and Bristol is quite a radical sort of left city, or certain wards are anyway. So is it the national picture? Is it also there has been a collective anti-mayor, particularly probably anti-Marvin sort of alliance a little bit from some of the other parties, which has resulted in the mayoral position being taken to a referendum and then a public voting to get rid of that. So is it a reaction to some of local politics, or is it actually suddenly everyone's becoming more green conscious and see the Green Party as a better viable alternative than Labour, or is it something else?
I mean, there could be a range of things. I mean, we weren't polling particularly well in 2021. We weren't popular as a party nationally. We'd had our worst election defeat since the 1930s, I think it was, in 2019. I think the party has taken a long, hard look at itself as to kind of what happened and has been on quite the journey, actually, to get itself sorted out and really make sure that we're speaking to the needs of it and the interests of voters, because we, you know, we lost seats all over the country.
Are you sort of supportive of the new, shift to the centre?
I'm supportive of where the party is currently at. And the reason for that is parties that are in opposition can't make change very easily. You know, it's very hard for Labour at the moment with the amount of MPs that they've got nationally to be able to influence change. We do so successfully. I think, you know, talking about childcare and basically obviously getting nicked by the Tories. But, you know, we need to be in power if we're going to affect change and do really good things for people across the country. You know, if we look back to when we swept to power in 1997, you know, the amount we were then able to subsequently do, sure start, investment in the NHS and investment in education, housing, yeah, all sorts. It's because we were in power and that we were able to do that. So we do have to make sure that we are electable as a party, and we have to appeal to a broad base of voters. And I think, you know, the Red Wall's a good example up in the north, where we more or less got wiped out in 2019, where we're now polling very well. Not that we're taking anything for granted. You know, they're voters that are will have different mindsets, different
they
priorities.
Are, but they're also voters, you're right, but they're also voters that are very different than Bristol. And I wonder, and I guess that's the point I'm driving at a bit, is that where nationally there's clearly been a shift to becoming more electable, perhaps a little bit less navel-gazing, a party of protest, a we are not kind of thing that is banded around. However, I would say there is a sizable amount of wards in Bristol that are pretty sort of quite Corbynista, really. And is there a danger of them, you know, even more of them sort of shifting to the Greens? Because the Greens have become a bit more left-wing, haven't they, in the last couple of years? So they're sort of pivoting a little bit as well as Labour have been, I think.
Have they, or are they just kind of trying to appear to pick on the right issues? I think there is an inherent contradiction in them at times. You know, they talked about backing council housing at the 2021 election, but actually then, you know, you've had council housing schemes that have been initially called in or have been objected to. As well, you've had supported housing schemes that have been called in, not supported. So I think that there is something in there about kind of appearing left-wing or appearing like you're supporting kind of sort of socialist values, but then not actually following through on that when push comes to shove. And I think there's that tension often between sort of telling people what they want to hear, but then actually having to enact things, which obviously when you're in power in leadership roles, you have responsibility to do. So I think there is a bit of that. I think you've also got a bit of a difference in different parts of the city. I think you've almost got an outer belt where it is a bit different perhaps to the inner city as well. And you can kind of almost see that a bit in terms of perhaps the current electoral makeup, sort of the concentration of Green Party councillors is currently sort of very, very central in the city, isn't it? And where you've still got quite a few, well, for now, Tory councillors on the outer areas of the city, and where also Labour have got more councils as well. I find that dynamic quite interesting. As well.
Sure. So you're going to have to work with these people, though, aren't you, now? As you move into the committee system.
Yeah.
And I find it really interesting of doing kind of media outside of Bristol that there is this perception, not just amongst journalists, but amongst politicians, that Bristol is this sort of left, sort of utopia, progressive alliance where, you know, the Tories and nowhere to be seen and everyone gets on great in this sort of kumbaya moment and, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, it has been, you know, anything but that. It's been pretty toxic, I would say, particularly between the Greens and particularly between Labour for a multitude of reasons for the last few years. That's going to have to change now, isn't it? How are you going to do that?
It has been challenging, but I think that's not to say there hasn't been cross-party working on things. You know, you've had the local plan working group where councillors from across the parties worked together. In my first 12 months on cabinet, I set up what was the big housing conversation to look at investment in our council housing stock. What would the priorities be? What was people's views on rents? And, you know, as part of that, we had cross-party work and we had events where all councillors of all parties were invited to the Home Choice Review. Again, there was a cross-party, a kind of stakeholder group that we set up with representation from the different parties. So there has been that cross-party working. I think there's also always the theatre of full council. It is a bit theatrical at the best of times, I think it's fair to say. And parties are going to have debates and trade blows. Mm. You know, I think that's par for the course in
politics. That's then amplified and picked up by the sort of democracy reporters and then picked up by the press. And it's a bit like Parliament, really, isn't it? It becomes theatrical when politicians I've spoken to sort of off the record, I'll say, well, a lot of stuff gets done that you don't really see conversations to take place, you know, in the corridors that paint a slightly different picture. Would that be your experience as well?
Yeah, I think, you know, there is the work that takes place outside of the chamber and the conversation that takes place outside the chamber where we're trying to work to find solutions to really tricky issues, because being local government has not been an easy task. And I think particularly on the housing agenda, you know, where I've been able to have tried to secure that cross-party support to move things forward. And you see that reflected actually when the budget votes are done. We obviously have four formal votes, the delegations vote, but there's a vote on the general funds, a vote on the dedicated schools grant, and then there's a vote on the housing revenue account. And in each of the last 3 years, it's been almost unanimous on the housing revenue account. And, you know, there has been work done outside of the formal kind of meetings to try and secure support, talk through some of the challenges, you know, work through, you know, why is it we've needed to do that rent rise to make sure we can invest in the existing stock as well as borrow the money we need to get new council homes built or required in the city. So although that there will be coverage and it will look like the parties are capable of working together, I think in practice there has been incidents of cross-party work, and there's been the budget task and finish group as well. So it does happen. I think because we're now obviously in election mode, you know, us as Labour will be setting out why we're different to the other parties, why we should lead the city and why we don't think the other parties should be
which is going to be a bit of a weird situation, isn't it? Because it's going to be, yeah, presenting your case, but presumably, you know, as politicians do, slagging off the opposition. And then post-election, you've got to sit down and work together. Is there a kind of acceptance that that is just the rules of engagement in politics a little bit?
There's going to be debate, isn't there, about ideas. There's going to be debate about why parties are the best ones to lead. That will, you know, have an element of, I think it will get spicy. I think it's fair to say. I mean, like, taking a look at my Twitter feed over the last few days is always fun, sort of seeing what some people think of, you know, what Labour has put forward. So it's, yeah, a bit of that. But, you know, post-May, once the dust settles, we will be working to make sure that we move the city forward and that we get things done for the city, because, you know, the residents of Bristol can't afford for us not to work with the other parties as is necessary to get what we need to done.
Okay. Let's look at some policies then. Let's look at your brief first. That's been your cabinet lead in housing. Keir Starmer at the moment, and obviously this is a big issue nationally, but also a big issue in Bristol, has rejected calls for rent controls, which Sadiq Khan has made in the Mayor of London and Jeremy Corbyn himself backed. Do you think that's the right call at this stage?
So I think,
because am I right in thinking you've called for rent controls yourself in the past? Is
yeah,
that right?
No, I have. It's still a position I maintain. It's about what's the right model, and it's about making that policy and evidence base clear. And, you know, we haven't finished that work yet locally. We've obviously had the Living Rent Commission. We've had the report that the Living Rent Commission has produced, which had 29 recommendations within it, of which one section is on rent controls. Then I've been engaging, including with policy think tanks nationally, around what that looks like and, you know, what are the models, how could they work? And the next piece of work we need to do in Bristol, sort of as part of taking those conversations forward further, is what if we were to be given the powers, and obviously there's a question about whether we ever would or not of a government of any colour, we need to be clear on what our ask is first. And that's the piece of work that we're going to do in a real policy way, because, you know, I think whilst I still back them, I think we need intervention in affordability in the private rent sector. It's one of our two biggest causes of homelessness at the moment.
Sure.
You know, alongside
why is a Labour leader not backing it then?
I can't speak for Keir on what he has and hasn't said. I can only speak for the situation, the reality that I find in Bristol and the work we're therefore trying to do around it and make that policy case, and we'll continue to do that policy work and then see where that leads us. I think the other thing I would say, though, if we're going to really address affordability, then we need to get homes built. And that is a big focus of Labour nationally, as well as us locally. We need more homes built. We need more of the right type of homes. We need more social rent homes built, in particular, whether they are council homes, and we've got an ambitious programme around that, or whether they are, you know, through housing associations as well, because that's the thing that will make the material difference, will relieve pressure as well on the private rented sector. And obviously there's a real challenge for us as well because of the ambitions of the universities in terms of growth and the pressure that's obviously putting on the private rented sector and rents in the city as well.
And affordable housing targets are always tricky. Rarely do they get kind of hit. You have been fairly outspoken, and as have many members of the Labour Party, about the kind of NIMBYism that happens in Bristol, not exclusively because there are, you know, environmental campaigners, but people in and around the Green Party. How are you going to continue to push more houses to be built in the face of opposition?
So
now that you have to work together more closely.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously cross-party planning committees make the ultimate decision, right, in terms of what gets approved and what doesn't. That's the case now. That will be the case post-May. As well, obviously, I have views around kind of how well those development control committees have been functioning or not. I think,
well, what is your view on that?
So I think one has probably functioned better than the other. And I think we've had challenges in development control committee. BR members don't kind of feel safe to attend those meetings. There are some of the challenges that there have been, and that's been really hard to navigate and really concerning to hear from what are our women Labour councillors about how they felt at a meeting that was back in last November. And I think one of the things we've got to make sure, you know, whoever is chairing what committee, whether it's development control, policy committees and all that, that we make them inclusive spaces for everyone to share their views. But just coming back to kind of house building across the city.
Bristol's been tricky, hasn't it? I mean, that seems to be at the moment the kind of main part of the city where it's becoming, would it be fair to say, a little bit toxic, a bit challenging, the environment, people, you know, that obviously where there is a lot of green space, there's quite a fair bit of organised opposition. How are we going to move beyond that?
I mean, most of what has been built under the Labour administration has been on brownfield lands, you know, formerly developed lands of one form or another. We also canned proposals on a couple of green spaces, you know, Western Slopes, you know, being a really clear example, still building on the brownfield former school and part that on off the Bellstone Walk. But I think, you know, what there is for some communities across the city is if you're going to build houses, then what about the infrastructure to go with them? And, you know, I think that's a fair challenge and a fair question. You know, we need to make sure that people can access GP appointments, dentist appointments, there's good community spaces, a good amenity, there's good retail opportunities, you know, the transport works. And I think, you know, those are justified concerns. And I think as well, one of the challenges, of course, is that the reason some of those concerns are there in the first place is because the NHS has been deteriorating. We've had, you know, I think 24% satisfaction in a recent survey compared to 70% at the height of Labour's power in the late 2000s. So, you know, it's also reflective of the current state of the country as well, and some of the services not functioning. And it's right that policymakers, and we address it in our manifesto, you know, we talk about alongside the services and facilities communities need. And that will be important both in South Bristol, in the centre, where there's going to be a lot of development coming forward, you know, City Centre, Temple Quarter, St. Philip's Marsh, White House Street, you know, as well as development that is coming forward in the north of the city as well. You know, Lotley's, you know, has a lot of homes coming forward, hundreds of homes in the next few years.
If local journalism is going to survive, we need enough money to keep the lights on. The Bristol Cable has not only managed to survive, but to produce quality journalism which, for almost 10 years, has changed lives across our city. We're looking ahead, hopefully, to another 10 years. To do this, we need members to help us unlock a bonus grant. We're now 55% of the way to £60,000. Head to thebristolcable.org/join to become a member or up your contribution.
You came to the city as a student. One of the biggest gripes I hear from just kind of ordinary people really is student accommodation popping up everywhere and the kind of changing nature and shape of the city. Is that something you're mindful of moving forward?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the Tories removed the caps off the amount of students that universities were allowed to have. And so, you know, with the change in face of higher education, the marketisation of higher education that has happened, they are focused on growing to sustain themselves. I think there needs to be a conversation about what's sustainable in terms of what the city is able to deal with and cover. Because with purposeful student accommodation, if we don't build it, it doesn't stop the students coming because that's not within our control as a council. So, you know, that's one thing to consider. It then puts more pressure on the private rented sector. You know, the University of Bristol, when I came to uni at UWE, I think their student numbers were probably in the region of around 18,000, 19,000. They're now closer to 28,000 to 30,000. You know, that's like significant growth over the last 15 years and will be contributing to the pressures that we're experiencing in the private rented sector and the cost of renting. So, you know, building
and
more
some students, and I was talking to a couple of students a few months ago that they were putting the accommodation in Newport.
Yeah, it's crazy and shouldn't be happening. And so, you know, there's a question mark about growth of universities, right? But then there's also about making sure we have got enough accommodation, and, you know, building more purpose-built student accommodation will inevitably take some pressure off the private rented sector. It's also can be done quite densely as well. You get a lot on quite a small site, and that will also contribute to the local economy as well. You know, students do spend money in the local economy. Dual contributes, which helps to generate jobs, helps to fund bus routes as well, you know, so there's more frequent bus routes that everyone can access in some parts of the city. So there are those benefits, but it's about that balance, isn't it? And make sure that local residents aren't feeling kind of priced out of areas. And there's a range of things we need to look at as part of addressing that. And obviously the University of Bristol's got quite ambitious plans for the future. And, you know, I think the Temple Quarter Enterprise Zone and the new campus will be fantastic, and you know the city as a whole will benefit. You know, they're a big employer, but we do have to have that conversation around what the city can cope with, and we're going to need to kind of move that forward. And you know, as part of the local plan working group, one of the things that has been done is caps were put in on purpose-built student accommodation to try and kind of manage that by allowing enough to kind of deal with what's needed, but also to make sure that not everything that comes forward or most things that come forward are purpose-built student accommodation, because we need to house people in the city that already live in the city as well.
Well, it's a problem, isn't it? It's a problem, isn't it, where people are unable to buy a house or grow up in the area in which they came from. Let's just pivot slightly if we can. I want to talk a bit about the condition of some of Bristol City Council's housing, which is a big deal in the city. You know, there's been a lot of talk about pulling some of it down, but I mean, last year, particularly some of the blocks in the city look like they might even fall down of their own accord. So what are you going to do to ensure nothing like Barton House, for example, ever happens again?
So there's a huge amount of work that's been happening with stock, and there's been tightening regulations, which I think is really good as well. You know, there's a new regulator in place for the focus on condition of stock. All stock holding authorities as well as house associations will be inspected over the next 4 years by that regulator to look at what they're doing. And we've made significant investment in our existing housing. You know, as you'll know, I signed off proposals be a year ago now in the previous budget rounds that included 100 million for fire safety works, or what is now 100 million for fire safety works, to put sprinklers in all our blocks over the course of 5 years, to remove the expanded polystyrene system cladding that is on a lot of the blocks, and also put in communal fire alarms. And whilst those things are happening, you know, there's waking watches in place while they're needed as an interim safety measure. But the other clear thing that we have got a lot to do on is knowing what's going on in our stock. You know, we need to be doing stock condition surveys. And again, I signed off money at Cabinet last June for over 20,000 stock condition surveys to be undertaken in the next 2 years, so we can be proactive and identifying what's going on in our stock, you know, proactive rather than reactive, and also make sure that, you know, there are people that probably
would
never
complain. Would you say in the Barton House situation that you were, as a council, reactive or proactive?
Both. You know, ultimately, the issues were discovered off the back of surveys, structural surveys that were commissioned by...
But you knew for a while, though, didn't you? You knew for a while.
I was informed in September last year, so the report had been kicking around for a while before that, but I got informed in September last year. And when I got informed, that was what then led to the further surveys being commissioned. And ultimately, as the outcome of that report became known, the evacuation that then took place. So, you know, we have been responsive when issues are raised and when they're brought to our attention. But there is
a lot.
Do
you think you could have managed the message a bit better, or how it was communicated to residents or to the general public?
I mean, it was an incredibly challenging situation, right? You know, because, you know, no one's going to apologise for putting resident safety first and foremost, because that's absolutely what needs to be done. And it was a hugely challenging situation. Obviously, you know, the briefs changed as well around that time. So I handed over to another cabinet member, Housing Services, mid-late October. I think, you know, the council, the officers, and the political leaders that have done the best that they can in what has been a very challenging situation. I think I would absolutely accept that, you know, communication, there's always more that we can do around communication with residents, and we need to constantly be thinking about how we can do that better. But the situation was unprecedented for us, I think, in Bristol, and there'll undoubtedly be a lot of learning, and people are trying to do their best, and we just need to make sure that we know what's going on in our stock, that we do those stock condition surveys, that we're carrying out tenancy audits as well, so that we know who's in our homes, that we know if there are vulnerable people, and make sure they're getting the support. You know, the thing that always kept me up at night is, you know, finding out about a resident that may have kind of passed away in our stock that we hadn't known about for months and could have done something about. And so, you know, really trying to push to make sure we're doing those things is important. And we have got a journey ahead. You know, we're not where we need to be in terms of the condition of our stock in the council, but we are investing significant sums of money. We've signed off increased investment in electrical safety inspections as well. That went through in the first budget I oversaw back in 2022. So there is a lot.
Let me just jump in, Tom, if I can. I'll just stick on the Barton House thing. Obviously, this was something that, and it doesn't happen very often in Bristol, actually. You know, we've had it, obviously, sort of Colston statue. We've had it with some of the protests. We've had it with some of the recent terrible stabbings in the city. But Barton House became a national story, didn't it? It was on the national news. There was also a sort of counter story to this, which amplified everything, which was the, you know, and I know you're kind of in the thick of this a bit, or certainly were in the thick of this a bit, was the relationship and the animosity between the council and the union Acorn. You were a director of Acorn for several years.
I was.
How difficult and how tricky was that for you?
I think in terms of, obviously, with the way things had changed in terms of the political setup with Barton House specifically, I wasn't the lead member, so wasn't as, I was on the periphery of it, of course, but I wasn't as close to it. But if you're sort of talking more to stuff from a couple of years ago when we set up the Living Rent Commission, you know, that was challenging to deal with. I was involved in Acorn for, going back to 2014, so 8 years, and was the first national chair that was an elected member as part of my director role. And then, you know, during that
and
time...
And you represented Acorn on the Bristol City Council Homes Board.
I did, and nationally on campaigns as well.
And, you know, you were accused by Nick Ballard, the founder of Acorn, of being a traitor who used Acorn to further his own career. Did those comments hurt you? And is there any validity to it?
I certainly wasn't happy with those comments. There's no validity to them whatsoever. You know, I've been involved in a range of kind of activism and campaigning around mental health and housing, not just through Acorn, but through other routes. And as mentioned earlier, you know, led my own charity, which I'd set up and founded many years ago to give people lived experience. And there was a range of stakeholders that we tried to get involved. So there was tenant representation through the Fair Renting campaign, which I believe Acorn are also involved with, as well as Shelter. There was representation from Bristol Older People's Forum, Black Southwest Network. There was representation from landlords and estate agents. We have to hear from all voices when we're dealing with complex policy issues. You can't just ignore stakeholders. You know, they don't have to agree with their view, don't have to implement their view, but we do have to hear it to make informed policy judgments, as well as people from different professional backgrounds made up that Living Rent Commission. I think that the mayor gave a very clear steer that Acorn weren't to be on it, and that steer was implemented.
Was that a bit of a personal thing, though, between two personalities?
I don't know what the motivations were. I don't want to comment, to be fair. But ultimately, what we had is we did have tenant representation on that commission from an organisation solely focused on tenants' issues, which was the Fair Renting campaign. Now, obviously, that didn't go down very well. And then, I mean, when I spoke to the Acorn representatives about that on the Monday. On the Tuesday, we had the first meeting, I think it was, roughly. I forget which day was what. But that first meeting then had to be aborted because obviously it was attended by protest, which meant that meeting didn't go ahead after the Green Party had kind of let them in the building and let them organise in a room up the hall. And then I think by the Thursday, whatever it was, you know, they put out a press release saying what they'd said. And I gave a very strong rebuttal to that at the time, which is in that piece that Tristan wrote. So it's not something I accept. I gave a huge amount of time and energy to that organisation whilst I was involved.
So were you kicked out? You were kicked out in the end, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I decided to do. Yeah. I decided it wasn't worth the energy to challenge it, and the fact they hadn't really even followed their own constitutional processes in doing what they did, because, you know, you are meant to give people a right of response and things like that when you're deciding on termination of membership.
And was it at that point you then became more embroiled or more involved with politics, with the mayoral team? I guess less protest politics, more party politics.
And I still campaign on the issues that matter, and I still met with Acorn after that point at various points to listen to issues and concerns that they were raising on behalf of residents. So, you know, I think campaigning on issues is important. There's a range of tactics and ways we can campaign to secure change. You know, I've challenged national politicians on the kind of their approach to issues, including writing to Michael Gove. You know, I've been to the select committee that was looking into issues in the private rented sector. So I sat down and gave evidence at that. So, you know,
so you're saying you can still be a campaigner and be a politician. You can still campaign on particular policy issues. You can still campaign and not be a member of Acorn.
Yeah, of course you can. Yeah. And like, you know, as I say, my track record on campaigning predates Acorn as well as drawing and separate from them as well.
But their charge of you using this to further your own career
That's nonsense.
Which is what they're saying. You could, it sort of come home to roost a bit because you're now, I mean, it's worked, doesn't it? Because you're now the leader of Bristol Labour. In a way, well, that validates their position, doesn't it?
I'm not leader of the Labour group because of Acorn. I'm leader of the Labour group because, you know, one, I've been elected to be that, but also I've worked on a range of issues, done a lot around policy issues, campaigns to improve things in the private rented sector. We've dealt with issues with rogue landlords. We've focused on bringing back council house building at scale. You know, we've put forward plans for 3,000 council homes over the next 5 years. And as I say, you know,
would it be fair to say you are personally politically ambitious though?
I'm ambitious to be in a position to be able to effect change that's going to benefit people in this city. And like, you know, I actually wouldn't.
Well, not just this city. That. Didn't you also stand to become the MP candidate for Gloucester?
A couple of years ago. Yeah, it was later the same year as in 2022. But since then.
But that's not just being committed to Bristol, is it? That doesn't that demonstrate that maybe you just want a career in politics?
I don't think so. I mean, that was 18 months ago. I was encouraged to go for it and give it a try. So I did, and ultimately wasn't successful and have been very much focused on Bristol. And even during that selection process, you know, was very much focused on Bristol because it was when some of the original issues around.
Right, obviously, if you'd have won, then you wouldn't be involved in Bristol politics, would you? You'd be in Gloucester.
Well, I probably would have been doing both, wouldn't I? Because it's, I wouldn't have given up my responsibilities and, you know, not delivered as a councillor or a cabinet member. You know,
you'd be able to do both. You'd be doing both.
Well,
you can't be an MP in Gloucester and be a councillor in Bristol.
That isn't what I said, though, Neil. To be fair, that's not what I said. But also, you're talking in hypotheticals that aren't the reality, right? Because I wasn't selected.
The accusation is that you're, I guess, a political careerist. You're saying I'm doing this for the city of Bristol, this sort of altruistic motivation. But you've obviously clearly had eyes and ambitions. There's nothing wrong with that. Eyes and ambitions to become an MP outside Bristol.
I think, and you know, I openly acknowledge that I went for a selection process, and that was back in, you know, August, September, October, November, December 22. And, you know, a lot has happened since then. You know, I've done some leadership course as well, you know, focused on local government. And actually, you know, the more I've got into my local government role, I've really enjoyed it. And, you know, I've since become leader and want to focus on Bristol, want to focus on being leader of the council.
Would you stand as an MP if an MP seat became available in Bristol? If Kerry stood down or, I don't know, Thangham or whatever?
Don't think that's likely to be on the cards for a very long time. So I'll be very much focused on local government for now, because actually you can affect more change in local government. That's one of the things that, you know, I've really found, you know, doing the work that we've done around investing in housing stock and trying to get homes built. You know, the national policy stuff is important, right? But then it's local government that's got to implement it. And I've got more involved in the local government association that represents councils across the country. I sit on one of the boards as a substitute.
I guess what I'm driving to is that you've started off having a good relationship with some of these organizations. That's fallen away. You've gone in a slightly different direction. Is this a bit of a problem on the left? Do we spend too much time arguing amongst ourselves and the wider public don't really care or are that interested? And actually, this is something that the right, when the shit hits the fan, even if they have as much infighting as the left does, when the shit hits the fan, they gather around. Is that something the left can learn a bit more?
Yeah, it's a good question. Like, you know, I think my perspective is that I think sometimes on the left, yeah, there can be a bit too much navel gazing and a bit too much kind of what I'd call ideological purism. Like, you know, if you're not fully with us all of the time, then, you know, we see you as against us. And like, you know, we do not live in a world where that is going to work with reality of the situation that we're dealing with, complex situations, dealing with complex issues. And I think, you know, take Acorn as an example, that, you know, there was that ideological purism at the time of the Living Rent Commission. You're either with us or you're against us. And, you know, actually, you know, what has that achieved for them and their aims, you know, in terms of what they were trying to do? I carried on that work. I stuck that work out in spite of everything that happened. And, you know, it wasn't a great time. I had to turn my Twitter off for several weeks because of the abuse I was getting on my social media after what happened, you know, with a very young child at the time who was a matter of months old. So, you know, it wasn't, I'm not looking, you know, for sympathy on
No, but I think this is important. You know, this is important. We said at the beginning, didn't we, about being a human being with a family and stuff like that, regardless of political position, validity or lack of validity does affect. and have impact. It was also quite good grounding for what you're doing now, though, at the same time, I think.
Oh, it really is.
Yeah. 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 Because there wouldn't be many councillors that would have had that level of, you know, hostility. Somebody once said to me that the left look for traitors, whereas the right look for converts. Do you think there's some truth to that?
Maybe. I think, you know, the other phrase I chuck in is don't perfect be the enemy of the good. You know, when we're dealing with complex situations, we're going to have to make decisions that aren't going to please everyone. And we can't not make those decisions. We can't be all things to all people. That's why we have political parties. It's why we have manifestos. It's why we have policy programs. And it's something I think, you know, at least one of the parties is going to have to learn. You know, we deal with really complex situations. We're dealing with people's lives. We're dealing with inadequate funding arrangements in local government as well. You know, they've seen a lot of money cut from our budgets. And then we've got increasing cost pressures. You know, over 60% of our budget goes on adult social care and children's services. It is really tricky. And, you know, I can't just therefore not make those decisions. You know, we have to do something, because otherwise what happens is things will just freeze up. We won't make progress. And actually things may get worse anyway, just because we don't take X, Y, or Z decision doesn't mean things are therefore going to somehow improve. Yeah.
And there is always going to be blowback that comes with that. Yeah. And I think I do wonder sometimes whether at the moment with the rise of social media is that there's a danger in Bristol that we react to some of the loudest voices that aren't necessarily representative. And I'll put something to you, and I'm going to put it to the Green Party as well, in fairness, is that it feels a little bit like they're mopping up quite a lot of sort of social media activists at the moment to stand for them as a councillor. Do you think that?
I think it's an interesting view. I think, you know, there's a lot of people that obviously are...
They're crossing the Rubicon, aren't they, from being campaigners to councillors, which is interesting. There's the fellow that was involved in Barton House, who they've had to suspend already. There's Danica, the American Green campaigner in the South. There's obviously Christine Townsend sort of came into that from campaigning, you know, countering Colson in education. These aren't like traditional sort of Green Party people. They're sort of being mopped up as an anti-Labour alliance in some ways.
Well, it's an interesting proposition. I think, so you will get community campaigners, right, that will stand for all parties. We've got community campaigners that are standing for us, and we've got, this time, we've got an amazing set of candidates. And I think one of the things that has been interesting is it is quite difficult to distinguish the Green Party from Acorn Bristol at the moment. And, you know, I think when you're running a city, you have to look at a range of issues. You can't be beholden to one organisation and their policy programme. You have to consider, you know, what's in the best interest of the city as a whole, what's in the best interest of people from across the city. And also, you're often having to make imperfect decisions. And, you know, I think going on that journey from campaigner to then being in a position of power where you've got other levers you can then pull. And that, you know, that shift isn't easy. You know, I had to kind of learn that going from campaign, or suddenly I can just say, well, that's what I want done as a cabinet member. And that's the thing that then, you know, should then happen, whether it does or not, is, you know, you kind of got to learn to navigate the bureaucracy.
And some people can make that transition. Some people struggle, I think. And it's probably a little bit of a kind of cheap shot, but there definitely does seem to be a mopping up of, I guess, people that would be on the left, sort of lapsed Corbynistas a little bit, moving into the Greens. And what you said about campaigners coming into politics, the irony of all this is exactly what happened with Labour before. It's exactly what Asher Craig was. It's exactly what Marvin Rees was. These were community, you know, these are people I knew in the community, campaigners, people that were involved in issues, yeah, that then went into politics and probably found and had to go on that journey themselves.
Yeah.
So it would be really interesting to see how people adapt to this now.
I think it will be. And we need to make sure that the support is there for people. Because I think, you know, ultimately, you know, when we start off with the campaign work, and I think about my work in mental health, which is really at the heart of what I'm, you know, hugely passionate around, alongside housing and my own lived experience, lost friends to suicide over the years. And, you know, one of the things that you then think about is, what are the routes for me to be able to effect change so these sorts of situations never happen again, or I can improve things for other people? You therefore go, well, yeah, okay, you know, I will stand for council. And I was encouraged to stand for council in 21. I mean, I was selected in 2019. So obviously, we were due to have it in the 2020 originally. And I think that transition isn't easy. But you will get campaigners, because we want to make change. We want to achieve social justice. We want to improve things for the lives of our communities. And we'll all look at different routes to do that. You know, yeah, I've looked at the parliamentary route alongside local government, and now my focus is on local government and trying to make sure that we can make the change that we need in Bristol so we can improve things. Because, you know, we are still, you know, divided in some parts of the city. You know, the opportunities and prosperity hasn't been fairly shared. And, you know, we need to make sure going forward that opportunity prosperity is more fairly shared, that the changes that are going to happen at Temple Quarter and some of the other big regeneration areas, that actually kids, you know, from Hartcliffe and places of higher deprivation do benefit from, can get
those
jobs.
Well, that's the key, isn't it? And that's the key, and that's a pushback to being, I guess, criticised as compromising or being too centrist, is that if there isn't a perfect world and everything's sort of council run and, you know, people are quite cynical about big corporations in Bristol, I think, instinctively a little bit. Yeah. But I think that those criticisms would be tempered when, and Temple Quarter is a really good example of that, you know, sits on, you know, right next to Barton Hill and the Dings, some of the most deprived areas in the city, that are we going to see people from deprivation areas, working class communities, benefit more from some of this investment? That's the second bit, isn't it, that probably needs to be a real focus as we move forward in the next few years in Bristol.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I think one of the things is we're not going to be able to do that on our own as a council. You know, we need to do it as partnership. We'll, you know, continue to back the one city model as well.
Do you think that will happen? Do you think people will back that?
Do I think it'll carry on? Yeah, I think it needs to. And I think, you know, it's been a real success of the Mayoral administration one city approach, because it's brought organisations together. It meant that during when COVID kicked off in earnest in March 2020, we were able to stand up structures very quickly to bring people together.
This is essentially, for those who don't know, there's six themes with people representing across sectors from public, private, third sector charities all together, which I know is the kind of vision of the mayor, really. And then those of us that have been around in the city a long time know this, that there were frustrations sometimes around the lack of momentum from the council to get things done from organisations outside of the council house. And it's bringing those people in to be involved. That's the positive. The criticism is that it's not democratic, it's a little bit nepotistic. And how can you ensure that those charges don't stick and it can be more inclusive, less selective?
So I think, you know, there was when the board went through a bit of a review after I was elected, there was then an expression of interest process. So, you know, anyone had the opportunity to apply. Obviously, there was then a selection part to that process, but there was an open process to apply to join those boards. I mean, a couple of the boards, particularly the Health and Wellbeing Board, has quite a statutory function and therefore has a particular membership that relates to its statutory duties. But, you know, they've had cabinet member representation on them, and we're obviously elected and then appointed and are able to be a bit of a focal point. There'll be an opportunity to look at how our
politics... But there's a snag. That's the snag, that, isn't it? The cabinet representation is only the Labour Party. That's been the snag, hasn't it, for, I think, for opposition parties with this. Well, I wonder if there's another way of perhaps tweaking it a little bit as things move forward.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're going into a committee system, so there's that opportunity to look at, you know, how does that representation work? But how do we then make sure that, you know, if you're going to have politicians from multiple parties involved in these boards, if that is the direction it ends up going in, how do we make sure they remain productive spaces and don't become another jousting spot?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Not a lot of people get that. What did you say, jousting?
Yeah, don't go another jousting spot, I think.
Yeah, which, like, I guess what you mean is just being contrary for the sake of it. Argumentative is that this is about trying to make collective decisions. I understand the frustration sometimes of people that want to get stuff done, which is the sort of hashtag, isn't it, that the mayoral team use, when everything you do, there's a it becomes, you know, that this is a space where people want to be making progressive and positive decisions. So I guess maybe there's some service level agreement, or there's some kind of, I don't know, shared mission statement or something that people need to adhere to. But I can't see how having six different themes, you know, culture is one, young people is one, and having a range of people together in a room, getting together to make shape policy, can be a bad thing. Even if you absolutely hate the mayoral role or hate Marvin himself, because it was his idea, his inception, I can't see how that can be a bad thing.
Yeah, you know, we need to keep the role of one city front and centre. We need to keep a focus on partnership work, you know, after work partnership to drive investment into the city. You know, the council can't fund all of the things we want to do in the city. You know, that would be obscene, the amount we'd have to borrow, you know, to do all those things, and what would be well beyond fiscal rules. So, you know, it's important that we do work with the private sector, we do work with our voluntary and community sector, that we work with community organisations from across the city to make sure that we're focused on the issues that matter and focus on strategic issues as well through those boards, you know, we haven't got the funding.
Do you anticipate now in the cabinet position that some people might feel, well, we won't do that because that's Marvin's idea? That you might get some opposition that you might have to push through, or are people at the moment in the other parties seem quite positive about the one city system?
Yeah. I mean, I'd be interested if you're planning to put that question to the other party leaders.
What I will be.
I think we can't get into this kind of tit for tat space, can we? Because that was what Marvin set up. Well, that's because I, you know, what I set up or one of the cabinet members set up and did, that suddenly we just try and scrap it if there are then suddenly opposition people in control of certain policy committees. I just don't think we've got time.
But that has happened, doesn't it, before? That has happened in other issues where...
It may have done it. You know, I've only probably got more involved in the local government world in the last few
years. Well, I mean, it's even happening between both Labour mayors, isn't it? Over the transport, you know, there is a bit of a, I want this, you want that kind of thing between Dan Norris and Marvin. So I think that it's the nature of people in new positions want to put their stamp on things and create some kind of daylight between the previous administration. I just wonder whether you'll have a little bit of a fight on your hands on this, and which may be even harder if, you know, the Greens take even more council seats.
I mean, we'll obviously have to see what happens in May. Absolutely, people want to put their own stamp on things. I think there are ways to do that. And obviously, people are going to argue for different ideas as well. You know, you sort of mentioned kind of mass transit there or referenced it. And, you know, my view on that is that we need to be led by the evidence and just get on with what it is we need to do. Because we need to, you know, continue to improve how we move around the city, don't we? You know, we need to invest in cycling.
I mean, that's a key, that's a massive thing, isn't it? Needs to be sorted one way or the other. That's, you know, been Bristol's Achilles heel for generations, really.
Yeah, and we've got to crack it, right? And we've got to all work together to make that happen. And I'll be working with colleagues, you know, to do what we need to do to kind of advance transport improvements across the city. You know, we're doing really well on rail. You know, you've got the Portway Station, Park and Wides, that's opened almost a century, hasn't it? I think it's been since a new station in the boundary of Bristol was opened. Ashley Down later this year, Henbury and Brentry coming forward, Fulham North just outside coming forward. And then, you know, they're going to start exploring whether stations could come forward at Lockleys, at Ashton Gate, and St Anne's, I think, was one of the other ones. So, you know, I think that there is a lot happening. You know, there's a lot happening in that space, that strategic transport. We've got significant investment through CRS, STS, which...
Transport is also one area where there is a bit of contention between inside Labour, but also outside, that obviously there's more of a push for trams or buses. Yeah. You know, there's the underground front presented by Mayor Marvin Rees. There's different ideas being presented. I mean, that's one of your things you've put, actually, isn't it? Is actually bringing buses back into public ownership is one of your campaign things. There's sort of Andy Burnham, Beehive, Greater Manchester sort of model a little bit, yeah?
In effect, you know, we want to look at, so I think National Labour have said about restoring the powers to set up municipal bus companies, as well as, you know, making it easier to do franchising as well. You know, the current model of bus operation isn't working. We're seeing routes regularly get ripped out of communities and not continued, leaving people isolated, and that isn't right. And so we need a different approach to buses. So, you know, we'll be working to push the case for public ownership of public control of buses and, you know, make sure we get more routes restored back into the communities that need them. It's something for me is really important. I think the Labour Party nationally have said quite a bit on.
So why haven't you done that before?
I mean, why is it folks were now? I guess, you know, certainly something that I've wanted to put on the agenda, and I'm now leaving the party. So it's more of a focus for us. Also, you know, I think the prospect of a Labour government, hopefully, fingers crossed, on the horizon means there's potentially going to be more opportunity now than there has been under...
What's interesting, so I mentioned Andy Burnham. He said that he wants to bring an underground into Manchester, and he said Bristol definitely should have an underground.
Interesting.
Yeah, and a lot of people probably on the left would use Burnham as a sort of barometer of lots of things. Do you know what I mean?
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that. So that is interesting.
I just want to leave on your quote, which is quoted in Bristol 24/7. Tom Renyard says, unlike the Green Party and the Conservatives who block and oppose, Labour has a plan to bring opportunity and prosperity to every part of Bristol. These missions you've got, is this national Labour or is this just local Labour?
Yeah, so you've got the national missions, which might be what you've seen, but we've also got our manifesto that's up on the website now. If you just go onto the homepage, you'll see a link towards the top, and we've got five sections to the manifesto, so kind of a lot tighter than I think previous manifestos we've done. And the five sections cover building brighter futures, moving forward together, which are on the transport side, protecting the planet, a safe, inclusive Bristol, and our city, our future. And that sets out sort of our key plan, our key offer to the city. I'd really encourage everyone to read it. I think, you know, I'm really excited by the programme we've pulled together, which has been informed by party members, by conversations we've had with residents, and people will be able to get behind what we want to do and how we want to move the city forward and back Labour at the election.
And target, do you have a target number or specific target areas?
I couldn't give too much strategy away. Obviously, our overall goal is to be largest party so that we can really put our policy agenda in forward and hopefully implement.
Well, best of luck, Tom, and good luck in the new role. Have you got a range of different red ties, or is it just the same one you're going to keep bringing out?
I've got two red ties. All right, best in the third.
All the best. Take care.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Many thanks to Tom Renard, the leader of the Bristol Labour Group, for joining us on this week's episode of Bristol Unpacked. I'm Neil Maggs. Big thanks to our production team from the Bristol Cable, also Blue Dot, for our music.